Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello everyone, it's James here. Before we get started with the show, I'm just dropping in an extra little bit here that wasn't on the version that's been out on Patreon for a day or two because we had some sad news in the Oasis fan community today and the Oasis podcast sort of listener community, which is that our Susan Tadeon, who's a lovely lady from America, has sadly died. If you're following along, if you follow on Twitter or on, I think I've mentioned her a few times. I know she was suffering from cancer for a while, and her family jumped on Twitter today and confirmed that she has sadly died. So I just wanted to dedicate today's episode to her. And as much as that might be nice for them, I suppose a far more significant dedication is that Liam Gallagher tonight, playing in Limerick, has dedicated Live Forever to our Sue, as he'd called her before on Twitter, as like a little shout out for the fact she was suffering from cancer. And so amazing. And it's literally, you know, we only heard from the family that she died earlier today, so Liam's obviously seen the tweets flying around and he's dedicated Live Forever to her. So absolutely brilliant from Liam, well done. And and just your wishes, prayers, if that's how you feel, to the family of our Sue. Anyway, on with the show. And Live Forever, our Sue.
Known as our Sue. On Live Forever.
Thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are all right. It's been a bit of a mad few weeks if you're a football fan, because we've had the Euros on. And and as I'm recording this on Saturday, we don't know what will have happened. So if you're hearing this on Monday, you probably know. Interestingly, England have got to the final to play Spain. And so, yeah. All very exciting, very interesting. What's going to happen? Who knows? Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy it. But for now, let's have a new Oasis podcast episode, shall we? So today I'm talking to Anna Doble. She is a journalist and writer and an editor for BBC World Service. And as we talk about in the episode, she wrote a blog that came to my attention over lockdown, where she was like going through and listening to every album in her collection, which was interesting. And then she's written a book called Connection is a Song. And and it's all about her musical journey. So if you want to get hold of a copy, I would definitely recommend it. It was a really, really good read. Like I said in the interview, as you're reading it, you're like, God, she can really write. You know, it's like, it's so hard to write about music. And she just writes about it so well. Especially the stuff about Oasis, it's really well written. So if you want to listen to or read a really interesting book about music and someone going through that musical journey in the 90s, then definitely pick it up. So we'll get onto that in a sec. News-wise, I suppose the biggest thing that's happened since we last spoke is that Liam has just played Transmit. Now that the DM tour is finished, he's now into these shows in these like festival appearances. So he's still playing the Definitely Maybe songs. Apparently Transmit sort of, it was on TV. I haven't actually watched it yet, but it was broadcast on sort of BBC Scotland. So if you've got the right sort of Sky package or whatever, you can see that. So I've not watched it, but from what I've heard, it was like a good performance, but then pretty flat crowd. Which you kind of expect, I suppose. Like we said, a lot of those Definitely Maybe lesser tracks were sort of falling a bit flat in front of like dedicated Liam fans. So when it's a festival crowd, you don't necessarily expect them to be going mad for like, you know, Bring It On Down or whatever. I don't know, but anyway. So apparently he's performed well, but we'll drop in a little clip here. The other point, I suppose, since we last spoke is Glastonbury happened and Noel was there. And so, yeah, he was sort of out watching bands and he was he did an interview with Matt Morgan all talking about it. I suppose the only thing that really made the news was that he then was quoted with Matt saying like, oh, it's a bunch of like it's all gone too woke or whatever, which is a classic kind of Noel bants with Matt Morgan. And made headlines. But, you know, it is what it is. They just all talk shit to each other, so what'd you expect? But it did briefly make headlines, which was interesting. And I suppose another like small point really is that the BBC have released a new podcast series called The Rise and Fall of Oasis. It's sort of 8 episodes, 20 minutes long. I've not listened to it, to be honest, because What am I really going to learn? I know a couple of people, to be fair, have listened to it and said it was really good. So, I mean, to be fair, I'll check it out at some point. I'm sure I might listen to it on 2x speed to just get my head around it. But if you have listened to it, do feel free to drop me a line, let me know. Or if you want to do an audio review of it, that would be cool, because then we can cover it on the podcast without me having to listen to it, which would be handy. All right, well, look, I think that'll do it. I did mean for this next episode to be me covering the Noel documentaries, which I still need to do. I think, we'll probably do that next time. Plus, I really want to get back to the A to Z, and I think we're going to do Head Shrinker next with our good friend Katie Georgiou. So that's going to come up very shortly. So for those of you who have been annoyed that the A to Z's gone away, it will be back. Also, I mentioned in the episode coming up with Anna that I'm thinking about bringing back that Britpop History podcast. It's ended. I stopped, you know, in July last year because I was following through month on month, you know, every year in Britpop, exactly 30 years on. And I lost track after July 23, focusing on July 93. But actually, I think I'll have the time. I think I'll come back and do August, but just instead of 30 years on, 31 years on, go back to August 93 and sort of catch up with myself. So if you think that would be good, if you're interested, I mean, it didn't get the listeners Oasis podcast gets, but it got a few. And I know some people did really enjoy it. So I may well bring that back. Let me know if you would like that. All right. Without any further Freddy ado, who has not been playing at these Euros, let's cross over to me with Anna Doble. Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl. You say he loves you more than me. Well, I will set you free. Go with Welcome to the Oasis podcast, Anna Doble. How are you doing, man?
I'm all right. It's lovely to be here. And I'm very excited to be talking about the band that wasn't Blur in the 90s.
Who were they? I've not heard of them. Yeah. Well, you're a big football fan as well, right? So it's an exciting weekend. We're recording this on Saturday morning. Yeah. Oh, and tennis. Okay. Well, yeah. But yeah, we're recording this on Saturday morning of the 13th of July 2024. And so, yeah, tomorrow night, England are playing in the Euros final. So, yeah, I mean, you're a big football fan. I know from reading your excellent book, which we'll get onto. But, yeah, how are you feeling about that?
Oh, James, one question, because by the time this is in the ears of your fandom, it will know, won't we, what happened?
I know.
I mean, it feels different to the last Euros final, doesn't it? I feel like there's a sense of a bit more kind of like what will be.
Yeah.
We're playing a great team. We're not quite feeling the pressure like we did when it was on home turf. We kidded ourselves, didn't we, that we were the favourites somehow against Italy. Whereas this time it's clear that Spain are. So I feel like it's going to be a good match. That the team, of course, have got better with each match, haven't they? So yeah. I feel hopeful for a decent quality match, but don't ask me to predict the winner. Even all the big guns like the Gary Linekers and the Alan Shearers have turned a bit and they're starting to dream and hope too much, aren't they? And it's sort of a dangerous place to be for an England fan.
It is. It's good fun. Just to stop you with the wee stuff, I'm a Republic of Ireland fan. As you can tell from my accent, I'm County Tyrone born and bred. So it is.
Okay. So, well, I apologise. Your surname should have given me the clue, actually.
Do
you get drawn into England fandom, though?
I do. I mean, to be fair, you know, I've lived here. I've lived in England all my life. Like my, you know, I'm half Irish, but my dad's side is, you know, he's one of eight, and my mum was an only child. So I'm just like a million Irish cousins, Irish family, and so that's always just been the way it is. But yeah, no, I do. I mean, to be fair, like I it's a classic. It's sort of similar to how I feel about the local teams to me, like Oxford and Reading, in that I'm happy when they win, but then I love it when they lose because I can go and take the piss out of my mates that support them. So it's kind of a, you know, I'm in a win-win situation, really, which is good. But no, I'm...
One way of coping.
And often with England, for me, it really depends on the squad as well. So if there's players in the squad that I like, then I sort of think, yeah, I'm happy for them. You know, I think,
yeah,
there was that, the end of the golden generation. They're just some miserable bastards. And like, and they were all like horrible. There was a lot of horrible men in that team, like people that had famously cheated on their wives or, you know, there wasn't that many good people that I'd actually be happy to enjoy their success. Whereas now, actually, with this team, it's like, you know, Saka and people like that, they just seem like really lovely guys. Okay. And so I'm like, yeah, I want them to win for them. So, yeah, I will be cheering England on. But then when they lose, I will be happily roasting my friends on WhatsApp.
I'm with you on them being nice. And I think, you know, all the criticism Gareth Southgate gets, he seems to have instilled a sort of sense of togetherness. And, you know, the players seem like they look after each other, they're mates. You know, you hear stories from way back, sort of 90s, where we're heading in a minute, about, you know, how teams from Spurs all sat together, teams from Manchester United all sat together, and there sort of weren't, you know, those divides, the club divides carried over into like the England squad or the England camp. But you feel like that doesn't happen so much now. Well, that's what the sense we get. But you're right, they all seem really sweet. And even Jude Bellingham, who's getting a bit, I guess, a bit more sort of leadership figure, isn't he? He's still just a young boy. So you kind of think he'd have got a sweetness beneath the kind of sort of arrogance that you need to be that kind of player.
See, I love, obviously I'm an Oasis fan, so I love that. I love the arrogance. So as much as I, you know, there's the snidiness and the nastiness I don't like. Whereas someone like Jude, what was it he said the other day? Who writes the scripts?
Yeah,
I do.
Me.
You go, oh yeah, that's great. What a great line. That is like, forget the media training. Just going with like a cool like that. You've got to then back it up, you know. But we'll see. Well, we'll know by the time this podcast will probably be hitting the people on Monday morning. So it will be a lot of headaches one way or the other, but we shall see. Cool. Well, look, you know, I know it's interesting that obviously football is a big part of your life. And I know with the book as well, what I really enjoyed reading your book, Connection is a Song, is that
Our lives really follow pretty closely. I mean, like we're, you know, as you're going through like 1990 World Cup and as it's like a memoir, like through song and how it's impacted your life at various times. I'm like, oh my God, that song was massive to me exactly the same time. You know, we're about the same age as well. So, and it's not necessarily even the Britpop stuff, but you know, Shakespeare's Sister, Stay, you know, watching that on TV on Top of the Pops, being like, well, this video is crazy. You know, just all these like amazing songs, even pre-Britpop, that were like just weird and dark and strange or quirky, you know, that period. I think if we start off there, like late 80s into early 90s, there was just some really weird and cool pop music about.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you picked that one out, because when people ask me to summarize like what kind of music is in the book, I sometimes kind of have a moment of a blankness where I'm like, oh well, there's actually some normal pop music in there as well, like Take That, you know, features and E17 feature. But actually, Shakespeare's Sister, I sort of forget they're there quite early doors, and you know, what a moment for pop music that they were kind of like beamed into the living rooms of the nation with this odd sort of sci-fi gothic video, and this brilliantly kind of pantomime sort of duo that kind of just made kids like us just really notice. And you know, you hear these legendary tales of people older than us, the first time they saw David Bowie on Top of the Pops in makeup and everything, and then they had this epiphany of, oh my God, you know, this is this kind of alien being that is going to change pop music. And of course, we've got our own sort of mid-90s moment where proper bands took over Top of the Pops. But actually, you're right, as kids, as actual young kids, so I'm 11 in 1990, it was songs like Stay that, and Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor, that had that incredible video as well. It's those things, those kind of moments that were actually more gobsmacking in a way to very sort of young eyes and sort of tender ears.
You'd better hope and pray that you make it safe back to your own world. You'd better hope and pray that you'll wake one day in your own world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was so, you know, that's the thing. I think it was so rich. There was a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And I tell you what, just a quick aside, news-wise, you know, you mentioned about Take That, and obviously Take, you know, you can't sort of forget Take That. They were so important in the early 90s. But I don't know, did you see recently Robbie Williams played that gig? What was it? I can't remember what. I think it was Hyde Park he played. Did you read about this? See his little mini Britpop nostalgia set he did.
I saw a clip, I think, of it on social media. Did he do Wonderwall?
No, he did. So just in the middle of his set, and it feels so like a, you know, like a end of the peer review or something. Hey guys, remember the mid-90s? He does Supergrass, All Right, and he gets Gaz Coombs out to do it with him, which is fair
Oh, did
enough.
he do Park Life?
He did Parklife, and he got Danny Dyer to come out and do it with
That's
him.
it.
And then he did Don't Look Back in Anger,
Right.
and you're like,
Good
oh
job of
mate.
it.
No, I mean, well, look, he can sing, and obviously the people in the crowd loved it, you know. But to me, that's just like, no, you wouldn't get like Johnny Marr going like, hey, remember this one, guys? This is you know, from the House Martins, Happy Hour. It wouldn't happen, you know. That you have to have a bit of self-respect. And then I sort of criticized him. And I don't normally, I'm not a troll. I don't normally like to criticize people, but you know, being the Oasis podcast, you do sort of have to dig into Robbie a little bit just to, you know, just to tribal allegiance. And I did get a few people, I suppose you get the rabid fans that look out there and say, oh, well, why are you saying that? You know, he's just providing a great gig for the people. And you go, well, fair enough. You know, if you're a big Robbie fan, then you probably weren't too bothered about like, well, was someone Britpop or were they pop or were they whatever? But to me, it's just cheese. Like you avoid cheese. It's like, well, what's he gonna do next? Hey, here's the remember this one, guys? This is Umbop by Hanson. What a tune. You know, it's like, no, come on, Robbie. Like, you got enough of your own tunes.
Brains I had went to my head. Step aside, summertime.
I'm just being a grumpy old.
I did see him in 1998 that famous Glastonbury where he did the afternoon kind of sort of the matinee performance as the sun goes down, and you know, back then 98, I was really like proper music snob. I was like, I'm only here for the indie bands. I don't want to see a pop star. I want to see, you know, Blur were playing that one, Pulp played that one, Primal Scream played that one. But then he played, and it was quite beautiful hearing angels sung by the Glastonbury crowd back then, when he was, of course, at the peak of his powers. Yeah. But yes, I don't want to hear a kind of what's the word, a Britpop medley.
I know. Stars on 45 does Britpop. No, thank you. Well, look, just taking it back a step. Actually, I first was aware. I was looking like, did I message you at the time? I don't know if I did, or maybe I might have quote tweeted, maybe had some contact, because I read the BBC article about your blog you did in lockdown where you went back and so I was like, oh wow, that's great. And around the time of lockdown, I'd started an offshoot podcast here where I was like, right, I'm going to listen to the 1001 albums you must hear before you die. I'm going to listen to all of them. And obviously there's no point in doing anything unless you're going to create content out of it. So I was like, right, I'm going to do a 1001 albums podcast. And fantastic. I got to 13 and then ran out of steam. So I didn't do very well.
I was going to say, I did about 330 or something like that LPs. So I just played every LP that I had. And I have about 350 records, I think. And and I got old guys having a pop at me for, that's not many records. I've got loads more than that. But actually, the act of playing them and properly engaging with them and giving them a proper, you know, side A, side B sort of reverence that records used to command from us. I loved it. It was great. I listened to music in a different way. And I had, you know, the world of streaming has really meant that we're quite naughty at jumping around and just listening to one track and then moving on. Whereas listen to, as I'm sure you agree, and people listen to this podcast will agree, an album is a beautiful thing and deserves a full kind of, you know, a proper sitting. And so I did that. And then I wrote a little blog for each record I listened to. It's sort of in rough chronological order. And when I hit the 90s is when I started to feel I had to write almost an essay per album. They had so many memories locked inside them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it was beautiful. It was really well written. And I find writing about music really hard. I mean, I find talking about music really hard because music is so special and it's so magic, and it's the way it hits you. And how can you describe, you know, do you go into like the, well, it's the way that Noel is playing an F major and then he changes it to an F minor and that's the magic, you know, or do you go, or the historical context? There's so many elements. And if you don't know the, you know, it's which route do you go down and sort of stuff. And so I've tried to write about music, and the idea was for me, I was like, right, I'm going to, you know, the one Oasis book we never had is just like the history of Oasis from all the way through. And I'm like, right, I'll write the book. I'll write it. And then sort of realized, oh, actually, I'm not actually a very good writer. I'm not very good. And it's only when you read other people, like reading your blog and then reading the book, it's like, this is really fucking good. Like it's really hard to write about music. And when it's like, yeah, like I'll just jump in forward. But like, you know, the way you write about Live Forever, I mean, that's the big sort of Oasis element is you describe Live Forever. Mm. And it's great. You know, I've read a lot of really bad writing about Oasis, and I've listened to a lot of, you know, not very eloquent people talk about Oasis, obviously. But yeah, you really capture, you know, when you read that Live Forever stuff, especially, like you really capture it. So, you know, kudos to you. No question. Well, there, but you're just fair play.
Thank you. I mean, I definitely don't write about F sharp and B minors because I don't know what I'm hearing. Yeah. I'm not musical enough to know. But I think for all of us music fans, and especially when music kind of became such a key part of your life when you were in your mid-teens, which is fairly common, it is about the way it paints the soundtrack to the most sort of like evocative sort of moments in your growing up. You know, you can kind of hear one chord or the start of, say, Live Forever, and it immediately plunges you into the feelings you had when you were 16, or the pubs that you were in, the awful taste of cider, the the dodgy, you know, brown cord flares that I wore over, you know, blue trim trabs. You know, just one note from a song from that era can sometimes do that. And I think if you can just write about that or capture your own sense of how it makes you feel, then other people will relate to it. They may have not had the same jeans and drunk the same drinks, but they can relate to it in the same way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that, and that's what I try, you know, when I get people, they'll do like reviews of, you know, Liam Gallagher gigs or whatever. And I'll say, you know, I don't want to have someone go, yeah, and then he played Rock and Roll Star. That was really good. And then he played Morning Glory. That was really good. It's like, no, that doesn't, that's fine. You know, like that, it's great. Thank you very much. But what I want to know is what the feeling was, you know, how did you have to queue up to get in, and or what were the people in the front of the queue talking about, you know, all of these little magical elements that you sort of, you know, that you think about or that, that happened to you. That's really what it's all about. That's where the, I think the story is. And yeah, and I like that. I like the way you jump around and like you, so you capture the music, but then it is about the memories and it is pulling you to these different places.
Yeah. I mean, one of the memories that I most enjoyed kind of really like delving into was what it was like walking into Nebworth, and we may come back to this, but how Oasis at Nebworth in 96, the process of just getting into the park felt like, I don't know, going to Narnia or something. Like the way that were you there?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
And they had like Oasis radio, was it called Supernova Radio, playing on little speakers before you could even see the stage. And it's things like that that only by writing them down, you're like, God, yeah, that really did happen. And then,
you know what? I was really pleased to read that in the book, because that's something I've said to people over the years. Remember there was like Radio Supernova? And people were like, no. But it's like, because we got the coach to Nebworth and they were playing Radio Supernova on the coach. And the one thing I remember is it pissed me off they weren't playing much Oasis. I remember the one thing I remember them playing was Scooby Snacks, Fun Loving Criminals was being played. I don't know if I've just got a particular memory of that being played. But yeah, I've got a vivid memory of being like, wow, this is great.
Yeah. So I got a coach as well. So I came down from Yorkshire for it. But, you know, I think I might have had a similar response to you. I can remember being a bit confused by it. And then when they played like three Oasis tracks in a row, everyone was like, yeah, this makes sense now.
That reminds me, it's completely different. But I went to Liverpool. This is before Liverpool became like, you know, Disneyland for Beatles, like in the probably late 90s, early 2000s, and went to the Cavern, or like, you know, what was called the Cavern then. So obviously they actually demolished the real Cavern. And the guy, the DJ, was just playing shit like pop, like and like shit sort of 70s pop and things like that. And I'm like, what are you doing, man? This is the Cavern. And he played the Beatles, talking about Stars and 45. He played the Beatles Stars and 45, the Beatles like mega mix thing. And I'm like, no way. And actually, like, you know, with a very kind of haughty self-sense importance, I actually wrote a little note and was like, what are you doing? Like, stop playing like this terrible music. You're in the Cavern. You should be playing like, you know, the sort of the Hamburg outtakes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I handed the DJ this note, and he actually said over the mic, like, all right, to the person that handed me out, I'm really sorry. We've got to play the shit that we're told to. That's it. So you think, oh, sorry, mate. I felt really bad about myself then.
Worst DJ gig ever, where you can't play what you want to play. But you're right, they could have been playing really great kind of 60s rhythm and blues, and then bits of, like, I don't know, throw in a bit of proper Liverpool, like, you know, unheard Liverpool gems. Like, my dad's from Liverpool, so I hear a lot about all the other bands. But around the scene in the 60s. But yeah, that poor DJ.
I know, I do feel bad. It's one of those things, why did I do that? You know, I was just the arrogance of
the sort of thing Liam or Noel might do.
Well, no, I suppose Liam would have just punched him and taken over the record.
Yeah, he wouldn't write it down, yeah.
But going back to Nebworth, you were saying that, like, I mean, you were, you know, you're happily to admit this, and it's fine. You can, you know, it's a safe space here. We are a broad church. You know, you were a Blur fan, a card carrying, you know, pro Blur in the Britpop wars. It's fine. You know, it is okay. That's all right. You won't be. I won't be publishing your address, but you can be safe here. But But yeah, I mean, but you still, and I think people don't realize this, it wasn't like one or the other. You did tend to favor them. But I even remember I was reading an old NME article where it was like, you know, the big question a lot of people were being asked in 95 was, are you Blur and Oasis? And the answer a lot of people was either both or actually Pulp. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, or like Space, you know, or various other bands at the time. But yeah, I mean, you going into the, you know, what was the idea? Was it just that you still loved Oasis, even though they had this battle with Blur the previous year?
What it was I was an absolute, like, really a real magpie for music, and, you know, still am really, but certainly at that point, reading the NME, the Melody Maker, all the other magazines, Select Magazine, every week. And I got the chance to go to Nebworth basically about 3 or 4 days before. So a friend of mine at school called Andy, I think he and his brother were meant to be going, and for whatever reason, his brother's ticket came free. And I think just because he knew I was into music, and he may have asked other people ahead of me that couldn't go. I mean, they must regret it. I just remember Andy coming up to me and saying, I've got Nebworth tickets and I've got a spare. Do you fancy it? And I wasn't like really close friends with this boy. He was just a nice lad. We played tennis together and stuff. He became a golfer, actually. And so I just thought, well, I've got the chance to go to what is being billed as like one of the biggest gigs, you know, ever, like in terms of size, just pure size. Nebworth's obviously already legendary in rock and roll sort of terms. And I just thought, I've got to go. I actually almost had a little moment of like, I'm 17 at this point. I knew that it was going to go down in history as like the most famous gig of the 90s, and I think it probably is. And I just almost had a premonition, I swear this. And so I just thought, I've got to be there. And so I said, absolutely, thank you so much, and whatever, paid him for the ticket, and like you, got a coach together. So it wasn't even like, oh, but I'm a Blur fan, can I go? It was just I knew this was going to be a key moment in the decade. And I, like I said, it's almost like my older self was saying, do it, take it. And I just thought it would be a really fun experience. And so just because I did have that little cheeky bit of tribalism in me, I wore a Blur t-shirt, which I think if I'd been a boy would have got me into more trouble than the fact I was a sort of skinny, quite young looking 17-year-old girl. So I didn't, nobody, I mean, I had a shirt or a tracksuit top to protect me if I needed to cover up and stop myself from being attacked by Oasis boys in their hats, in their, what do you call it, mammy hats. But yeah, it didn't happen. I was everybody was in just the mood was just so sort of excited and buoyant and fun, and so I just wanted the experience. And the other thing was, I wanted to see not just Oasis, but the support bands. It was a brilliant lineup. I saw the Manic Street Preachers that day as well, and fell in love with them almost, you know, on that day that I went. And you know, the other thing that I do write about in the book is, I was lucky enough to be in the bit of crowd where Liam and Noel like rode by on a golf buggy. So we just saw them all of a sudden, and a lot of fans hadn't even clocked that it was them. So I just thought, everything, there's something here, and I'm lucky to be here. It's only by a quirk of like someone else couldn't go, and now I've seen the actual stars of the show literally go past me in a golf buggy. I've seen the Manics, I've fallen in love with them as well, and it was beautiful weather, so it just felt like everything was right, and I needed to be there. But I did kind of, oh, and when Liam came on at the gig I was at, I think, was it the Sunday? I can't remember which way around.
Yeah, you were.
But
he came on
singing Parklife, or like doing a spoof, like his tape version of Parklife. So it sort of felt like it was meant to be that I was hiding a Blur t-shirt.
No, that is cool. People forget that, you know, it was a Britpop mini festival, basically, you know, and you've got, I mean, the day I was there on the Saturday, so I had the Prodigy, but I didn't get Dread Zone, so you know I think there's a good, but you got Cooler Shaker as well.
That's right.
Yeah, but we got Bootleg Beatles, Chemical Brothers, Ocean Colour Scene, Manics, Prodigy, Oasis. So, you know, I mean, what an unbelievable lineup that is. And I think you guys had you didn't get Prodigy, but you had Cooler Shaker and Dread Zone. So, yeah, I mean, just, yeah, I mean, it's, and like you said, I completely agree. It wasn't like I think we joked about our message before setting this up, is that, yeah, like when you look at it now, when you look at like the footage of your time, it's so young. The crowd is so young. I mean, it, like, you sort of think Oasis gigs get a bad rap and Oasis fans get a bad rap, but I think that's more for what it became in the 2000s. And it then became more tied in with like football hooliganism and like just, you know, this sort of chucking piss around and like, you know, and being deliberately aggressive and crushing like you get at football, or you like, used to get football. But no, it's sort of, you know, that wasn't the case in 96. It was a lot more, you know, a lot more friendly, a lot, you know, younger, a lot more female as well. It's a real split when you see
that.
The footage. Yeah.
Yeah, no, my memory is that I didn't particularly feel like I was in sort of a male sort of environment. It was just loads of young kids, like a bit like you say. It just felt like a festival of all the music as well. And that, you know, the drama of when would, you know, kind of like, how would Oasis reveal themselves? And like, would they, you know, like in my case, little cameo appearances in the day, would they appear with other bands? And obviously Ocean Colour Scene were best mates with them and all those connections that there were then.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good? It's Skyline time.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It just felt, yeah, and it was really youthful. And I guess, I mean, the term dad rock hadn't been coined back in 96. That came in the 2000s, didn't it? So it was harsh in itself. It's fine to be a dad and it's fine to like rock. But yeah, no, it was a great atmosphere. I didn't ever regret it. I was always very, very grateful to have gone. And you know, look, I might have been quite into the tribal thing then, but over those years since 96, you know, like I, in many ways, you know, in the book, I'm really harsh on other things like Jamiroquai. When I read the book back, because I had to do the audio book, I was like, God, I'm really a bit mean to Jamiroquai. It wasn't that bad. Just that everybody in my hometown seemed to like put Jamiroquai on the jukebox in the pub or have a Jamiroquai sticker on their car. Just seemed to be kind of like the sort of universal towny sort of artist that people had, like dodgy nightclubs would start with. So in the book, I am sort of writing on behalf of like my teen self, where it was very important to plant your flag and say, I like this band, but not that band. But I always loved Live Forever, which is why I have in my hand right now, actually, the cassette that I've got of Definitely Maybe on the market in my hometown. I remember getting Park Life and then getting What's the Story, Morning Glory. And then I remember getting Definitely Maybe off the market. So I got like almost like a weird bootleg copy of the album, but I loved it.
Yeah, so this is, I've not seen this one before. I mean, I'm not a big Oasis collector. I mean, I'm part of the sort of Oasis collectors group and things like that, but I've never been like a big collector that's aware of all these quirky ones. But yeah, just tell us about that. It's like a cassette version that was sold to like the Middle East or something.
Yeah, so basically, I'm from a town called Knaresborough. I went and there was always this stall that sold tapes, and even like current leases you could sort of get for like £3 rather than whatever £7.99 or whatever they were in Woolworths. So I one day was there in like 1995, probably, so a year later after its release. And I just saw Definitely Maybe. I thought, oh, brilliant, I'll get that bargain. Because I think up until that point, I would have had like just a copied version, like on a TDK tape or whatever, from my friends. Or most of my albums as a mid-teen were like copied off friends. Yeah. Or even more old school, going to the library and hiring it from the library for a week and then copying it. Absolutely. But yeah, so I saw Definitely Maybe, got it for, I'm pretty sure, £3, and took it home, started playing it. It's perfectly good quality. It sounds like as it should. But when you get to side two and track three, it says in the track listing, just cigarettes. So I was like, hang on, that song's called Cigarettes and Alcohol. Like, why have they printed it wrongly? So then I opened up the inlay properly, which I can show you actually in a sec. And I noticed that on the inside with a sort of green stamp, it says for sale in GCC countries only in English, and it also says it in Arabic. And so I must have worked out, even though pre-internet and everything, that that was Gulf Council countries or something like that. And manufactured by Modern Electronics in Jeddah. So it's like a Middle East copy. So of course, in the countries where this was meant to be sold, alcohol was not legal.
Yeah.
So they had to take off alcohol from the track listing. But when you actually listen to this copy, it's fine. It's just normal Oasis. I'll show you it. Like, it's, yeah, they don't bleep out alcohol, which would have been really funny.
That is weird, isn't it?
Have you
looked into like if it's rare on Discogs or whatever? Because it's I've not heard of it before.
I mean, my copy is, I played it as a kid, so it's not perfectly mint or anything, but it's decent. I don't know if you can see there.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because it's not like a bootleg one, you know, like it is an official release, but it's just one I've never been aware of. I mean, maybe in the collectors group, you know, that they'll go, oh yeah, there's thousands of them out there, but I've never heard of it, to be honest.
Well, I imagine that it came in a suitcase from someone who went on holiday and bought like 20 copies or whatever. And maybe, you know, that's how it found its way to the UK. But you're right, I should find out. I think I've tweeted about it before, hoping that some Oasis collector would come along and say, I want it. But here's your chance, people, again. A slightly battered cassette box, but inlay intact. Distributed by that well-known record label Megastar in the Middle East. God knows, it might be worthless.
You know what? And I've Googled, I can't find it. I can't find it. So yeah, I think you've got, you might have something there. You might be able to retire early, Anna. You never know.
That would be lovely.
There's some pretty mad Oasis collectors out there that might want to take that off your hands. But I'm sure you wouldn't part with it though, for sentimental reasons.
No, I couldn't possibly.
Of course not.
We'll see. Yeah,
absolutely. but is that, like you said, you've got Definitely Maybe, but you were part of the gang that was like, okay, you got into Morning Glory first. And then went back and got into Definitely Maybe once you got £3 together to get a hold of it.
Yes. I had the single of Live Forever on CD. So I must have bought that in my local record shop. And so I had the single of Whatever as well. So yeah, I mean, as a kid in mid-teens, mid-90s, I was buying a lot more singles than albums because you could pick them up like, obviously, you know, sometimes they'd be 99p, wouldn't they, in the first week to bump up the sales. So I'd get them, or 50p bargain bin tapes. And then I would get albums as and when I could afford them. And until then, I would, like I say, take them off friends or take them from the library. So, yeah, so I was kind of building up my collection kind of slowly. And very, you know, much in school, sort of saying, oh, blow a better, you know, but and fight. Because I was at school in Yorkshire as well, there was this sort of sense of you need to be on the side of the Northerners. What are you thinking? You know, being a fan of Blur, they're Southerners and they're posh. They're almost like red rag to a bull, made me like double down a bit. But you know, the actual debate we had at school a lot was who's better or who's going to mean more to music? Is it the Stone Roses or is it Oasis? So that was often the debate in our common room. I don't know whether we can answer that. I think probably, you know, this podcast's existence answers that question. You know, the history and the legacy and the fact that Oasis are still, you know, streams in their millions are, yeah, you know, today in 2024. The fact that young fans are coming and finding Oasis and listening to it, all of it's new today, probably means that they're probably the, you know, I'm sure the Stone Roses also pick up new young fans all the time, but I don't know. There's just less to go at, isn't there? The Stone Roses only did the, you know, a much smaller discography to get your teeth into.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you've got, like, I mean, if you think about it though, like the reverence that Oasis hold for the Stone Roses, though, that's the mad thing. So that even though, yeah, that other people went on to sell more than them, or, you know, or if you take it on a football thing, like, you know, like Cantona came to Man United and was the thing, the person that changed everything. But he only played, you know, I think I don't know, he was there for like 5 years and scored like 100 goals. Whereas then you come, like, Wayne Rooney comes in and scores double the amount of goals and plays twice the amount of games and wins far more trophies. But actually, if you talk to most Man United fans or older ones anyway, it's like, well, who would you have, Cantona or Rooney? They would pick Cantona every day because it's the catalyst, it's the special, you know, it's the special one. It might only be far less moments, but they're more powerful moments, you know what I mean? So
yeah, dude, it's a really good analogy, actually. And, yeah, and back in the sixth form, by the way, when it was Oasis v the Stone Roses as the talking point, I think I used to just drop in the Smiths and walk away. in terms of like Mancunian influence on music, you know, and Noel Gallagher himself would say, look, like, the Smiths lyrics influenced him probably more than any other. I guess Morrissey's not done himself any favors in the modern world, but
no.
I know that lyrically you can't really argue that you know, the influence of those sorts of lyrics about funny things, about very British things, about sort of odd characters, you know, and that the sort of that the it couldn't possibly come from anywhere but like the north of England. I think that, again, you know, you could argue is the most influential part of Mancunian music, but yeah, you know, you can debate this one for a long time.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, like, you know, it's Liam plays I'm the Resurrection before he comes on stage, you know, that's his come on stage song. And like, you know, Liam chooses to go and do an album with John Squire, you know, earlier this year and stuff. It's like, you know, they, yeah, in terms of like who gets the most streams on streaming now or whatever, then yeah, then Oasis are well ahead. But most Oasis fans, you know, are, you know, massive Roses fans. And like you said, the great thing about the Roses, they've got that kind of Brigitte Bardot thing or whatever, they went away, you know, so although Ian, you know, they've all gone and done solo stuff or whatever, but you know, there's this sort of one perfect album and then one album that I think is really great. You know, I think it's sort of, you know, almost a different band, but you know, like, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like the Pistols, you know, it's like you've got this one perfect album and then you haven't then gone on and had diminishing returns because you've just gone bang, there you go, perfect, walk away. So
yeah,
there's something to be said for that.
But, just like Menswear, James.
Menswear, absolutely. One perfect microcosm. I like Menswear, to be honest. I loved Menswear back in the day. I still do.
Nuisance is a fun little album, and I can remember that's by the point that comes out, it's a bit later, isn't it, I was like, had enough money on the day of release to just get it when it was brand new, and I vividly remember that was like, I've got to go get that album, this band are going to be huge, and you know, they're going to do loads of albums, and they did, I think, that one and then one other that was, I think, only sold in Japan. How weird
is
that?
Right. Yeah, Japan only release, which is really sad. But no, I mean, they've got a special place in my heart because that was the first time I was like, oh, I think I'd like to be a singer in a band. I think I'd like to do that. But it's quite a step to be like, yeah, I want to be a singer in a band and try, especially when you can't play an instrument or whatever. So we were just like at a mate's house, just messing about, and he was a bass player and he was just playing Daydreamer on cassette and playing bass along with it because it's got, you know, a good fun bass line. And I just sort of was like, you know, we were just recording on it, and you know, I'm just like slowly shifting, gently dreaming like that. And I'm like, this is fun. You know, you don't even have to sing as well because it's primarily a talky song. And I'm like, this is fun. I can do this. And so that was really my spur.
Moving closer, floating over, sinking into, dreamer.
So yeah, for the legendary never did anything mission, Menswear were a big part of that not success. But yeah, no, you know,
you do a good impression.
Well, yeah, that's thank you. That's yeah, well, that's Oasis for you, isn't it? It's just to, you know, get other people and copy them.
Dangerous talk.
No, it's all good fun. But yeah, no, I think like a lot of those bands, and it's like. What pisses me off as well, I mean, you talk about it in the book about, you know, the fact that Britpop got like quite a kicking. It's like you'll see it often on online and things where people say, ah, Britpop was crap. And you go, OK, well, what? It's almost like that Monty Python sketch. But what did the Romans ever do for us? It's like, what about Blur? Well, yeah, Blur are good, but Britpop are crap. What about Pulp and Suede and Supergrass? And you can list them off and list them off. And even if you widen it a bit and go, what about Paul Weller? And what about PJ Harvey? And what about, yeah. You know, you go Radiohead, you know, when you, if you want to list, you know, why you've got the debate of what is Britpop, but if you want to widen it to like 90s indie, Chemical Brothers, Prodigy. Well, yeah, they were all great. It's like, well, what Britpop bands were bad? And then it's like, well, I don't know, Northern Uproar, maybe you can have a dig at that. That tends to be the one I have a dig at. Menswear, you know, you can have a dig at, but I think they're great. But yeah, you know what I mean? It's like,
I'm with you all the way. And you know, that's part of the real kind of genesis of the book, actually, is I just wanted to set the record straight a bit on what a glorious time it was to be a young music fan. And, yeah. And that what a glorious era for like, being a magpie and because of what you've just described, you could jump from genre to genre, and one week you're into guitar indie, and like I was really into Radiohead as well, the next minute you're off to see the Chemical Brothers or you know, Orbital. And I know they're earlier 90s, but I got into, when I was at university, quite ravey kind of electronica and stuff, and because it was all there and all interconnected. And somebody like Jarvis Cocker, for example, from Pulp, would direct you back to the 60s and teach you about Scott Walker, and of course Oasis always reflected on you know, the bands from the 60s who influenced them, and ditto. So it wasn't just even the era that you were in, it was just that they opened the sort of the treasure trove. And you're right, I think revisionist history likes to kick things that, I suppose, the Union Jack, it became a source of like embarrassment, the fact that the Britpop scene was quite male, and then lots of drug addiction happened towards the end of the 90s, and a lot of these icons of ours, you know, Brett Anderson, you know, they've talked very openly about what happened to them at the end of the 90s. But we were still, I mean, I'll speak for myself here, but we were still kids, and like for me in my bedroom listening to my Definitely Maybe tape or my Blur Park Life cassette or other bands like Catatonia or whatever, the Welsh scene, it was all still opening up to me and all new to me and all still the source of great optimism about the joy that music could bring you, the emotion music can bring you. So the fact that the stars of the scene were all falling out and taking too much cocaine in the Groucho Club was irrelevant to me. I was like, I don't want them to be unwell, but ultimately the fact that lots of music journalists in London have declared the scene dead. I'm just starting, and I've got like, I don't know, I'm about to go off to do, you know, a degree, or I'm off, you know, I'm allowed to go out now. I can go to gigs on my own. My parents will let me stay out. No, it's all just beginning for me. So I just wouldn't accept anyone dissing the scene. And now, like, yes, it was quite male, but, you know, as I've said in the book, you know, I, as a girl, getting into music at that time, I felt like there were loads of bands with female front women, you know, Elastica being the one that was my favourite, but also Sleeper, Skunk Anansie, Echo Belly, loads of bands. Oh, cool. Kinnicky, with cool women showing girls that you can be like, you know, you don't have to just wear a frock and be demure. You can be the singer, you can be the bassist, you can be the drummer, whatever. And all of that is a bit forgotten when everyone kicks off at Britpop now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree. And there's been, you know, there's been quite a lot of these think pieces about, you know, well, look at pre-Britpop, you had like, you know, Bjork and PJ Harvey and people like that, and it all went a bit male afterwards. And there is some truth to that. And I think, you know, once then you do get flooded with a lot of those sort of, you know, lesser bands probably, but still really good. But no, I completely agree. And I think it really depends, I think, on age. I think you're about a few months older than me, but so, yeah, we were similar sort of, you know, experiencing it that little bit younger. And so I understand if you're like 24 when Definitely Maybe comes out, you know, and you've gone through, so your teenage bands were like, you know, the quirkier stuff in the like late 80s, early 90s. I can understand then if you are then the same as I sort of were, you know, dropped out of, you know, that sort of music, was interested in different stuff in the 2000s. I think that's probably where it is, that you've got people that were like, they sort of feel, ah, yeah, it was kind of over by then. Mm. So I think it is very much an age thing. Like, yeah, and then that even goes back to the 60s. Like the mods, you know, the mods who were a bit older, like scoffing at the mods, you know, who would listen to the Beatles and stuff in 64 and being like, oh, I can't believe you listen to that crap. You know, why aren't you listening to kind of Miles Davis, you know, whatever. But you know, it is very much, you know, it's these years, literally 1, 2, 3 years. And it's almost like when you talk to people, say, well, how old were you when Definitely Maybe comes out? That to me is such a big thing, because you can really tell what people's views are going to be. And I still judge people on that now. I still think, you know, like Pepe playing for Portugal, he's 41 years old. I'm like, yeah, he's old, but he was still only, you know, 12 when Definitely Maybe came out. So, you know, so he's... but yeah, I mean, going back to what we're saying, like that sort of era when people go, oh, well, it was over by 95. Okay, well, let's look at the best albums, Enemy's best albums of 97, shall we? Spiritualized, Radiohead, Verve, Primal Scream, Vanishing Point, Super Furry Animals, Radiator, Corner Shop, Mogwai, Teenage Fan Club, Supergrass, In It for the Money, Daft Punk, Homework, Chemical Brothers, Dig Out Your Hole. The list of 1997 best albums, or like even if you go to 98, there's some amazing stuff in there. And so yeah, maybe it wasn't kind of as vivacious and young as it was, and it's a lot of people onto their second albums or third albums that are then, you know, going through these things. But actually, there's so much richness in that period. And I think get us then being a little bit older, sort of 17, 18, then you start to appreciate it more, I think. So I think the timing was perfect.
I mean, stuff like, so OK Computer is 97, isn't it? So, yeah. And obviously the Bends, you might argue, is Radiohead's sort of all-time most loved album. But I can remember being absolutely mind blown by OK Computer, because and it was because we'd had the time to understand, like a bit, like you say, a bit more the depth and the sort of weird journeys music can take you on. That by the time OK Computer comes out, we can handle the oddness of some of those tracks, the sort of insanity of like the kind of getting inside Tom York's mind. I mean, by 97, is that when's Be Here Now?
August 97, yeah.
Yeah. So Oasis was sort of, they were probably, I mean, it's pretty well documented, right, that they were doing a lot of drugs during the making of Be Here Now. So there was that sense that the big success stories of Britpop, like, you know, were having their more dark days, you know, Jarvis Cocker on This Is Hardcore, or Damon Albarn writing the eponymous Blur album, you know, and then this sort of the kind of more hazy early 90s sound that came back in. But Oasis were almost just still loving their own myth, weren't they? And putting, you know, tucking cars in swimming pools. And so kind of, in a sense, they just kept the dream alive of like the madness of the mid-90s boom a little bit longer.
Yeah, absolutely. They're keeping the party going. Yeah. Whereas then, I think a lot of people kind of pick out, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about, you know, well, when's the start of Britpop? When's the end of Britpop? And I think that generally, you know, Britpop memories, and I especially, like, it's like, okay, well, if you start off with Pop Scene by Blur as the first point in 92, and then you end with the release of Party Hard, which is the last single from This Is Hardcore, in like, I think it's September 98. And I think that's pretty much like, okay, that's the core part. Then when you get into Blur's You know, with no distance left to run in Tender. That's not really Britpop now. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? That's different. And then Oasis come back with Standing on the
Yeah.
Shoulders in 2000. That's not Britpop now. You know what I mean? We're into a different thing now. But so we sort of tend to think of that like 92 to 98 as those kind of those are the kind of core years. But
I
yeah,
think I'd be
it.
happy with that definition. I like the idea that pop scene kicks it off. I think because of the Stuart McConey Select magazine article that declared, you know, the birth of a British scene with obviously Brett Anderson, but also like bands you wouldn't expect, like the Auteurs and Denim and Felt on the cover, and Saint Etienne, who I absolutely adore. But people think because he coined the phrase then of Britpop, Yanks Go Home, the birth of Britpop, people think it's 93. I often do argue though, and I love that 92 is there, and I think Modern Life is Rubbish is a Britpop album, but I feel like 94 is really, so 30 years ago now is when it was really beginning to feel like a scene, and that those big albums, so definitely maybe Park Life and His and Hers, were all released within this spell, weren't they? Exactly 30 years ago. So the last of the trio is definitely maybe, isn't it? So in August. So yeah, I feel like for me, and then as discussed, because we're 15, 16 at this time, or you might be a bit younger, I couldn't afford to buy the albums on release day. So for me, I discovered them in 95. So 95 is the year for me that I actually had the money to go to start going to gigs and to buy the albums and stuff. So, you know, it but 92 to 98, I would agree with, yeah.
No, absolutely. I'm in the same boat, and I think that's the crux. You know, there's so many, and I still, you know, I'd still have it now where it's like there's so many bands that, and it's, you know, it's listening to like the Britpop Revival show and stuff on, which is fantastic and always worth a listen. I'm hearing bands now that I remember reading about, but I never even listened to. You know, because I would like read The Enemy and read The Melody Maker, and you might catch one song on you know on the Evening Session, but I couldn't go out and buy the 60 Foot Dolls album. You know what I mean? Because I've spent my pocket money. You know,
Yeah.
you know. So I spent it on buying Cooler Shaker K. So I'm not gonna, you know, how can I go out and buy My Life Stories album? I haven't got any money left. So you know what I mean? So it is literally a case of borrowing. Like, you know, it dawned on me, I never owned Morning Glory until much later, just because I had the tape copy of, I think it was when I was going to uni in September, October 1998. I'm like packing everything up. I'm like, oh, I've literally got a gap in my Oasis records, and it's
That's
Morning Glory
funny.
because I never bought
Yeah.
it, you know?
So
Because
I got Morning Glory for Christmas. I think I got made sure that my parents got me it because, yeah, so it would have been the end of the year that actually got my hands on it. And before that point, as I say, I would have borrowed it off my friends and taped it and or got the singles. But one of the bands that I always talk about as the sort of one of there's loads of lost Britpop gems. But for me, do you remember Geneva?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I feel like maybe more people love the album than I realise, but Further and the track on it that I most love is Into the Blue.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
why the hell were they not bigger? What an amazing little album that is. You know, but we were so spoiled in the mid-90s. It was, like you say, first of all, financial. You couldn't have all the albums that you'd heard about. Secondly, an album would be like one album, like a week, would not have set the habit, because there was sometimes, like, you can sometimes look back and see two or three really amazing releases were actually in the same week or on the same day. So we were really, and I know that people will say now it's the same, you just have to look harder and so on and so forth. I'm sure it is. But the feeling of there being loads of new bands and new albums flying at you, and you just had to like take your pick and back a horse and hope that you'd chosen the one you love. And also that feeling of choosing music on the artwork, which is much less a thing now in the age of streaming. But yeah, so, you know, what, again, across dance music, across indie music, across pop music, there was just so much choice.
I think there's some, I mean, I once again, it's another podcast I started and dropped and stopped doing, but I was doing Britpop History, a podcast where I was doing like month by month, exactly 30 years on. And I started out in sort of 92 in 2002 with Pop Scene. And I think what I'm going to do is jump back on in August, because I stopped in like July 23 for July 93. And then life got in the way. But I think I'm going to jump back in next month, just because it was so great. Like you said, going back and listening to all those bands, and because I wasn't really into it in 92, 93. I'm same as you. I got into Britpop like late 94. And in earlier 94, I was more into like, you know, I found an old cassette tape I'd made, and I had on there like Jamiroquai, like you said, Meatloaf, you know, with that I Can Do Anything for Love album, like Terrorvision, you know, they had a load of hits throughout 94, like Some People Say and Pretend Best Friend and all that sort of stuff. Alice, What's the Matter? Like, I was into a much more eclectic, and then it was like, bang, no, now it's time, you know, I'm going to brush my hair forwards and like get rid of the curtains. And this is like, this is year zero for me. But yeah, so I think that's, you know, I think I will go and start that back again, because I was just getting into the good stuff. Like all these albums coming out, like literally, like, wow, on the same day, you know, this and this and this all came out. And you think that's mad, you know. But one thing I wanted to pick up on actually is I think you got into the Manics sort of in a similar way to I got into them, in that a little bit later, you know, I've got friends that were like, oh yeah, I saw them in 94 with Richie. And I'm like, you bastards, you know.
Yeah, me too. I never saw Richie.
No, I never saw Richie. And it was only sort of later on in like, you know, 95 when, you know, they came back. And it's like, you know, and my, you know, I've got friends and that were like, you know, no, you know, I loved them from the Holy Bible and before. And then for me, it's so vivid that I was driving up and down to uni. I went to uni in Leicester and I'm from near Oxford. And so, you know, I was still coming back home quite a lot. And I only had a cassette player in the car. And so for me, I absolutely hammered the Holy Bible and a couple of other Manics albums, like just going up, because I think I'd nicked them off my brother who had them on cassette. And the Holy Bible to me, like you're saying about like the way it takes you back to a certain place, is just driving up and down the road, up, you know, the M40 up to Leicester and back, you know. And I just absolutely hammered them and loved them. And I was talking, it was funny, like when I started uni, I was still, you know, I'm with my girlfriend at the time, who and now we're married. It was, we would meet up, because I didn't have a mobile phone yet. This is like autumn 1998. I would meet up with her on like a placebo chat page, like in the really early days of the internet. I would go to like a computer room on site, you know, on our campus in Scraptoft in Leicester. And because a friend of mine, this girl Kate, was really into Placebo, and she would go onto Placebo chat, and you could go in and you could direct message people on this Placebo, and it was like just a really, you know, I was like, and I'm not a big Placebo fan, but it was just a way of staying in touch with my girlfriend who was still at home. It was amazing. But you know, that, but yeah, that time, and it was like, oh God, that's so mad that I didn't even have a mobile phone. That was the only way to sort of stay in contact, and was then and Placebo chat. It's mad.
Yeah, it's so 90s. So I sent my first email in the first term of university. So it would have been, that would have been September or October 1998. Yeah. And I can remember on my course, and I was at Leeds University, that they actually had a little module which was showing you how to send an email, how to do an attachment, how to search the internet. So we actually had a class on how to use a search engine. Wow. And And I can remember, like you, like finding yourself in a placebo chat room. The first things I, of course, searched were like band names. And I can remember finding little sort of early versions of, you know, like the website for bands I loved. I think I was looking at Saint Etienne, who else? I just remember there being a really cute, like you know, like what we would call a GIF now, like flashing little kind of animated characters. The cast or another smaller, maybe a kind of blue tonesy type band that had actually like nailed it and actually got quite a cool website earlier than the others. But anyway, I can remember that feeling of like, oh my God, I can just type any words into this box and like find stuff about the music I love and like eventually, like you, find other people. And all that, then the early days of social networks like Friendster came along.
Oh really?
And, but yeah, I love it. And but going back to the Manics, I can remember the feeling of having to work quite hard to like the Holy Bible, because I would have been into like the like my friend who was a farmer, a lad who called Patrick, made me a tape with stuff like Little Baby Nothing and Faster and La Tristeza Gerrera and stuff from Gold Against the Soul on it. And then I finally could afford to go and buy the CD of the Holy Bible. And I got the copy with like the face of Christ repeating across it. So it's pretty kind of hardcore and a little bit like heavy metal-y, wasn't it? The whole vibe. And I can remember putting it on thinking, ooh, I might have bitten off more than I can chew here. this is not like Gorky Zygotic Monkey or like pleasant tuned and, you know, that kind of easy to like music. And then it just, you know, hit me one day, like the power of it. And of course, perfect timing when you're 17 and writing bad poetry and stuff. Richie's lyrics came along at the perfect time for me. So I then kind of worked my way back through the Manics albums for the early, 92 sort of era. And that was Holy Bible, was Generation Terrorist, obviously, was 91.
I think the album's out 92, but then all the singles came out 91, I think.
Yeah.
I think the album's 92.
Yeah. Yeah, but I didn't see them like you until unfortunately Richie was gone, and I saw them at Doncaster Dome and absolutely fell in love. But I'm trying to think, did I first actually see them at Nebworth? I think Oasis was sort of my gateway to the Manics, because it's the summer,
Yeah, well, it was very different, I think, because they were such, you know, it wasn't, you know, they were sort of an afterthought, really. And there's an interview with James Dean Bradfield from that weekend at Nebworth and on MTV, I think it's for MTV. And he seems quite depressed about it. Like he's just like, we thought we were big. And then you just see this. And, you know, he just seems a bit like, oh, okay, that's where we are on the pecking order then. You know, it's not like this, like, triumphant, wow, what an amazing experience. He just seems pretty sad. But yeah, like, I think by the time you get to, like, 90, you know, the sort of, the when they first come back, they're wearing the cargo pants, you know, in the 96, you know, Everything Must Go. And I think it's then when you get into 98, and Nicky's like, no, there's all the thing, like, I love hoovering. And everyone was there. Yeah. Then he puts the feather boa back on. And he's got that. I think they almost had to have that sort of, no, we're just going to be dour and calm for a little while. And then Nicky was like, no, I'm putting on the dresses and I'm putting on the makeup and stuff again. Mm-hmm. Because then I know that for me was the time when it was like, you know, and sort of going back and rediscovering that and like being like, wow, this is cool. And like, and I remember at the time, like, you know, going out and wearing eyeliner and like being like, yeah, this is great. I love this music so much. And I remember getting into an argument. It might have even been on Placebo Chat of someone being like, oh, who's the best bass player? And someone saying, oh, it's is it Mark from Ash? I think whatever the bass player from Ash is, it's called Mark. Oh, it's Mark from Ash. He's so handsome. And he'd be like, how could you? Nicky Wire is the greatest writer of our generation. Just being, once again, so fervent, you know, and so caring about it so much, because I loved the Manics so much at that time.
Mm.
And yeah, so it was that gap really between Oasis had gone away before they then came back in 2000. And I really got into them and like, and then much more political music. And, you know, and there's the bit in Faster when he says, you know, I'm stronger than Mensa, Miller, Mailer. I spat out Plath and Pinter. And it's like, right, scribble those down. Plath, who's that? You know, Pinter. Oh, Sylvia Plath, Belgium.
Absolutely,
okay.
Me too.
Morality,
That's how I learned about it. And it's awful, isn't it? Because you think, God, my English teacher should have introduced me to these names. But no, it was a Mannix. But it's interesting to me to hear that you kind of did the eyeliner thing, because probably unfairly, I thought sort of in the tribes of Britpop, Oasis fans just sort of found boys in eyeliner to be, you know, their enemy. But you're telling me there was actually a lot of crossover.
No, I mean, I think because I was in a band, I was in a band from like 90, when did we start? Like 97, like 96, just playing school gigs, but then actually playing like proper gigs in Oxford and Reading and into London into like 98, 99. And so we just missed it. You know, we were very Oasis and Charlatans-y and Stone Roses-y. Yeah. And so we were just, okay, we missed it by a couple of years. That's the only reason we didn't go on to be mega famous, obviously.
I'm sure that's true.
But yeah, no, I was always just a show off, really. So I would, I'd wear eyeliner and I'd like, you know, I remember we did a gig in London where there was because we were called Vision, and there was like a skate punk band also called Vision, apparently, that had quite a big following in London. And so a bunch of people turned up to this gig, like expecting all these like skate punks, and then turned up like, who the fuck are these? Like little, you know, indie kids from Oxford. And yeah, and so I went on and like, you know, would like emblazoned my t-shirt inspired by the Mannix, you know, writing culture slut and things on their t-shirts, like skate punk sucks and all this sort of stuff, just to try and wind them up. But yeah, no, I was sort of, I mean, I suppose like, just willing to sort of be a bit stupid. And I think there was that crossover, you know, Oasis, everyone, you know, you didn't have to be a, you know, a real laddie lad to like Oasis. Like we said, that did come later, I think. But yeah. Yeah, just a crazy time, really.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear. I write about eyeliner a lot. I used to carry an eyeliner in my pocket when I went out.
Just to try and convince boys to put eyeliner
on. Yeah, I did. I honestly used to pin them down. And the brilliant club in Leeds called in the cockpit was used to be on a Friday night. It was called Brighton Beach. So it was basically a mod night. Yeah. But loads of boys would, in fact, there used to be a really cool sight of like a row of Lambrettas and Vespas parked outside. So you knew you were in like the right place when you could see all the bikes were there. And I used to go in and obviously dance around to like 60s music and then Brit poppy music. And then, I would get my eyeliner out and say, right, let's get your eyes sorted.
But then the boys would be like, no, but then also, oh, well, but Damon wears eyeliner. You know what I mean? So it's sort of, you know,
I'm quite a you know, willing participants, but yeah.
It was cool. It was exciting. Yeah, I was still the other day, I put on some beads and then one of my kids was like, oh, Dad, that's a nice necklace. I said, it's not a necklace, it's beads. I'm not wearing a necklace. Yeah. Let's just be very clear about this. It's beads. Damon wears them. Look, watch Star-Shaped. But on that front, actually, I was going to just say, you know, so Star-Shaped was a massive film for me. As you know, I take it you are aware of Star-Shaped, the film.
Yeah, I love that. I actually watched it again. It's on YouTube for people who haven't got the original VHS like we do. But it's mad. I mean, he's absolutely, he's kind of obnoxious, isn't he? He's basically drunk throughout. So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel so bad for Graham throughout that period. He just looks so pissed off, like Alex is just such a twat, and you just see Graham like just desperately trying to be anywhere else than in the vicinity of Alex James, and then Damon. But no, I loved it so much. And then actually, you know, coming around, we've got the Blur film coming out in a couple of weeks, which is exciting.
I'm looking forward to it. But you are dangerously talking of Blur quite a lot on this Oasis podcast, James.
Oh, we love, like we said, it's a broad church. We love all the music. And people have been listening to this podcast for 7 years, then they accept that we cover all of it. But cool. Well, Anna, like, you know, so I suppose the book's out and it's done really well. Have you been pleased with how it's done?
Well, do you know what? I'm just so happy to hear like little anecdotes of people like yourself who've read it and just been sent straight back to their own teenage bedroom listening to music. I've had, you know, it's been about, 6 weeks, 2 months it came out in May. So there's been enough time now for people to have read it. And there's an audio book as well on like Audible and stuff. So people who aren't so keen on reading have had time to listen now. And loads of just, it's just so lovely. Like it just sparks conversations like this one, you know, people who specifically remember like the moment they first heard, you know, Massive Attack's Unfinished Sympathy or Underworld, Born Slippy or Live Forever or Heart Life. And then people just, It's so nice to share those stories again. And it's called Connection is a Song. So the whole point of it is writing about how music connects you with people, with places that you end up going, those chance meetings at gigs where you end up making a friend and, you know, back in the day took their number, nowadays maybe exchange like Instagram or whatever. And it's just, music is this beautiful thing that connects us. It's the reason you and me are chatting now. And so I love the fact that it continues to connect, you know, and kind of whether or not, I don't know, like there's a lot, my story is like the story of like a lot of people. It's not, I don't have a rags to riches tale. I don't sort of have some massive meltdown. I don't have terrible hardship. I'm just a normal kid, you know, in a school in Yorkshire, going through the aches and pains of growing up and then finding that music is the reason that I've become sort of more confident and all those things. So I think it's a story that a lot of people can relate to, and hopefully it's quite funny because, you know, I did a lot of dodgy things in the 90s. I puked cider often. I'm sorry, Mum. When my mum gets to that bit, I'm so sorry. She'll be like, you didn't need to include all of that. But it's what the 90s felt like, and the mixture of like the Spice Girls 1 minute, you know, a niche indie band the next. That's how it felt at the time. And so the reaction's been lovely. My sort of most amazing moment was Sarah Cracknell read it from St. Etienne and enjoyed it and said it reminded her of like being in a band at that time. Like, my God, you know, we were just the fans like waiting for your singles to come out. But she was remembering her own experience of being on tour and stuff. So lovely reaction. And I'm doing a few festivals and stuff this summer. So I'm going to be talking about it in Fields, which feels the right place for it.
Absolutely, very exciting. When you saw that from Sarah Cracknell, you're like, can I come round your house and have a cup of tea? Like, just be in your vicinity, please.
Yes, yeah, I was. It's an absolute dream come true for actual musicians to have even flicked through it, you know what I mean? Let alone kind of find their own memories in it.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So, yeah, no, absolutely dream come true material. And maybe we need to get a copy to Noel or Liam. Who would like it the most?
Well, Liam, famously, one of the Oasis books, I can't remember, one of the officially approved Oasis books, one of the photo-based ones, has a foreword from Liam. I think it's the only foreword he ever did. And it just says, a book without pictures is a shit book. So I don't think Liam is going to read it, to be honest. Like, I don't think his reading goes beyond like, you know, the back of a fag packet. So I think probably Noel would be the better person to get it to, I'd suggest.
Yeah,
Well, and so people listening, I'll stick a link to the best place to get hold of the book. And I did say to Anna, because she kindly sent me a copy, and so I said, well, look, I'll if we don't sell at least two on the back of the interview, I'll go and buy a physical one. So come on, I need at least two people to buy it. And when you do, tag me and tag Anna to let me know, let her know that I sent you, and then I'll try and get a finder's fee, a couple of quid from each one. So.
Well, that's very generous of you, very, very kind of you. And I will just say that if people do prefer listening, then if they've got a Spotify subscription, I know you shouldn't be endorsing specific platforms, James, but you can just listen to the book through like your Spotify. It's just there amongst the audiobooks. And then there'll be a paperback. So, you know, if you want one, you can chuck in your bag and carry around with you. That will come out in February. So fingers crossed, people will enjoy it. But it's been really fun talking to you. And anyone know any more about my weird Oasis copy of Definitely Maybe, then please do message James or me, because I have this odd Gulf Countries edition waiting to be enjoyed by an ice collector.
Yeah, with a very big checkbook. But cool. Anna, well, thank you so much, mate. It's been really great. And hopefully enjoy the football tomorrow.
And
good luck with all the various parts of the book and you're talking in fields about it in the summer.
Thank you, James.
All right, catch you later. All right. Thank you very much, Anna. Real pleasure to talk to Anna earlier today. Very cool. Like I said earlier, great writer. Go and pick up a copy of the book and do, like I said in the interview there, do please tag me and tag Anna on Twitter or Instagram if you do buy a copy, because then I can feel smug that her appearing on the Oasis podcast has helped to sell a few. And if we don't sell at least two, then I'm going to have to go and buy one anyway. But there we go. I'd be more than happy to. Joking. All right, that'll do it for today. Thank you very much for listening. Most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is. It's greatly, greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post bonus episodes. The episodes go up a day or so early. You get access to the Discord, which is really good fun. Quite a bit of chat on the Discord recently. It's generally, you're helping me out, which is, the greatest thing, that warm, fuzzy feeling in your stomach, I suppose. Do feel free to drop me an email if you've got audio messages on, if you want to share your thoughts on any of the recent Oasis related stuff. And follow on social media. Oasis Podcast on Twitter is the place to be. Give us a follow on the YouTube channel. That'll do it. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.